Great. Good evening. Welcome. I'm Whitney Sweeney, President of the State Board of Education. I call the February 17th regular meeting to order. It is 5:01 p.m. This meeting is open to the public in person in the Townsend Building in Dover, Delaware, and electronically via WebEx. The State Board of Education published public meeting notice and the meeting link on February 10th, 2022 on the State Public Meeting Calendar site. Thank you for your patience if we run into any technology issues as we simultaneously connect this meeting in person and electronically. As a courtesy to others and to prevent unnecessary disruption, if you're logged in via WebEx, please mute your telephone when you're not speaking. Members of the public should refrain from speaking until the time for public comment. Today's agenda contains three opportunities for public comment. The first opportunity is for comment related to charter schools. The second is reserved for comment related to regulations, and the third is reserved for general public comment near the end of the meeting. Opportunity to sign up for public comment was available via email prior to this meeting. For those attending in person, sign-up sheets are available on the table by the door. If you did not previously sign up to provide public comment and are logged in via the URL, please type in your name, organization, and comment topic in the chat box now. This will help us to begin to create a list of individuals who would like to speak. If you're only participating via phone and wish to make verbal public comment, please log in via the meeting URL. We ask that members of the public utilize the chat box only to sign up for public comment or to make us aware of any technical difficulties. In order to maximize the effectiveness of the meeting, each board member should announce his or her name before speaking. Please remember to announce your name as you reply to others or participate in ongoing conversation. During the presentations, presenters will regularly pause and ask if any state board members have questions. Please refrain from speaking until this time. During the presentation, presenters will clearly reference which document they're reviewing. And when taking a vote on items, I'll ask if there's a motion and a second, and then we'll conduct a roll call vote. As required by statute, this meeting is being recorded. The recording will be available to the public on our website within 7 business days of this meeting. Ms. Honor, if you could call the roll, please.
Yes. Mr. Brittingham.
Here.
Ms. Ferris.
Here.
Ms. Pfeiffer. Absent. Mr. Lopik.
Here.
Dr. Noble.
Here.
Reverend Powell.
Present.
Mr. Rushton. Absent. Ms. Sweeney.
Present.
Ms. Turner.
Present.
We have quorum.
Right. Thank you. I'd note that we also have the following individuals participating in today's meeting: Secretary Mark Holodick, Deputy Attorney Carl Jaros, and State Board of Education Executive Director Jenna Honor. The next item on our agenda is the approval of tonight's agenda. The board's agenda was posted on February 10th. Are there any changes to the agenda? Is there a motion to approve the amended agenda for tonight's meeting as presented?
Lopik, so moved.
Audrey Noble, second.
All those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. The January 20th regular meeting minutes were provided to the board to review in advance of this meeting. Are there any additions or deletions? Is there a motion to approve the January 20th meeting minutes as presented?
Brittingham, motion to approve minutes January 20th, 2022 minutes.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? And we did not, everyone was at the present, so we don't have to have any abstentions. The motion carries. So the first thing on our agenda is the accountability update and a proposed path forward. So for this today, we'd like to welcome Chantel. I'm going to ask you to pronounce it for me because I don't want to do it that poorly.
No worries. It's Chantel Yanishevsky.
Yanishevsky. Okay. I'm really glad I gave it to you, and I apologize. I didn't know that beforehand. She is from the Department of Education in Accountability and Performance Management, and she's here to discuss the status and timeline that's related to updates on accountability. And just to note, this is not an action item for the board. This is part of the department's ongoing engagement with stakeholders as they work to inform the plan that's going to be submitted to the U.S. Department of Education. So with that, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. And that's absolutely correct. And we appreciate the opportunity to engage in this conversation with you. And Jenna, are you bringing up the PowerPoint? I see that you are.
You should see it now.
I do. Are you able to put it in presentation mode?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So again, my name is Chantal Yanishevsky. I am the accountability policy lead for the department, and just want to give you a quick update on where we are. Next slide, please. As a recap, this is a pretty colorful picture that captures our entire accountability system for the state. As a reminder, in 2019-2020, we had no statewide assessment data and we had no accountability data due to the waivers based on the school closures at that time. And then again in 2020-2021, we received a federal waiver from accountability again, and had very high variability in participation rates by grade school last year. So 2 years, two consecutive years of no accountability data and 1 year of limited data availability puts us in a very challenging position, if you will, for this year. But just as a recap for the components, go ahead and click, Jenna. Just to remind everyone about accountability terminology, everything you see there on the left in the red circle, academic achievement, academic progress, school quality, student success, grad rate, and progress toward English language proficiency, which is abbreviated ELP, those are referred to as indicators. So when I talk about indicators, I'm talking about these five big buckets. And click, Jenna. And then any of the smaller components that comprise those indicators are called measures. So when I'm referring to measures, I'm talking about these smaller components that make up the bigger buckets. Right, one more time. All right, and again, as a reminder, there are certain ESSER requirements that all states are required to meet. We must include all five indicators in our school accountability system. So all five of those big buckets that I just mentioned have to be a part of the accountability system in any state. Click. And then in the aggregate, the four academic indicators, so that's academic achievement, academic progress, grad rate, and ELP, have to be given much greater weight than the school quality student success indicator. So when we calculate overall ratings, we have to give those four academic areas significant weight in the aggregate so that they account for more of that overall rating for a school. One more click. And as another reminder, when it comes to identifying schools for improvement, we must also include all five indicators. One more click on this slide. The challenge that we're presented with this year is that we will not have a growth measure for 2022, primarily because of the limited data we have from 2021. We have to have 2 years of matched data in order to calculate growth. When you look at the varied participation rates across all of our schools, for many different reasons, it's just not a valid measure to calculate this year and use for high stakes decision making or accountability purposes. So that will be a missing measure and a missing indicator. We do have to have all five indicators, so I will come back to this toward the end with a proposed way to mitigate for that problem. Next slide. So on the federal side, US Ed did release draft guidance toward the end of December. It has now been finalized a couple of days ago to help states implement their accountability systems this year. So basically, accountability is back on, you know, to say the least. Guidance for temporary adjustments. Oh, go back. Sorry. Guidance for temporary adjustments needed for in the short term. That means just for this school year was provided, and an addendum template was given to states to use as a streamlined way to submit those temporary adjustments to US Ed for those flexibilities. Next slide. So some general observations about the guidance. Again, as I just said, the guidance affirms that all federal accountability and school identification requirements are in effect this year. So it was very easy for us to kind of turn the switch off on accountability in 1920 and 2021. It's not so easy just to flip the switch back on and say, okay, everything's back to normal. We're just going to pick up where we left off. That's not the case. This year is more like a dimmer switch year to try to get back to turning that light switch on completely, hopefully next year. So I just wanted to use that analogy to share that even though we are expected to get back to accountability, there are some flexibilities through that addendum process that I mentioned that will help us get back there and kind of restart accountability this year. We do have to identify schools for comprehensive support and improvement and targeted support and improvement in the fall using data from this school year. But we have flexibilities in how we identify them from what we said we would do in our state plan and how we exit them, as well as timeline. Go ahead, Jenna. US Ed has affirmed that participation requirements are in effect. That means the expectation is that we test 95% of our students in math and ELA. Part of the accountability system, and it's an ESSER requirement, is that we adjust proficiency rates and academic achievement for any school that falls below the 95% participation rate. So if a school tests 90% of their students and not 95%, we have to reduce their proficiency rates accordingly. That's not a state policy, that is federal policy. So that is back in effect for the 22 school year. Go ahead. And with the guidance, as I've mentioned, some modifications may be made to the indicators of our statewide accountability system, but US Ed has made it very clear that local assessments are simply not permissible for use because indicators and measures have to be statewide and comparable. They cannot be local. Next slide. So here's where we are in this process of sharing flexibilities in advance of submitting to US Ed for approval. We are working with local stakeholder groups for feedback and considerations. And again, thank you all so much for being one of these groups, that we value so much. We also have to include the governor's office for stakeholder engagement prior to submitting the addendum or any amendment to our ESSA plan for that matter at any time. And we will be posting the draft addendum for public comment. Our goal is to have that posted next week. And the addendum deadline to US Ed is March 7th. That is not a hard deadline, that is actually, it's a strongly recommended deadline because US Ed has indicated the states that submit their addendums first will of course be viewed first and get feedback first. So we're going to try for that March 7th deadline as much as we possibly can, but we also don't wanna compromise the broad stakeholder engagement and talking with our groups across the state before we submit. Next slide. So here's the feedback slide, if you will. These are the major areas where we are proposing flexibilities and would like for your thoughts on this. So one area where we have flexibility is with our long-term goals in our ESSA plan. These are the ones I believe were shared with you last week on page 137 in our ESSA plan at the end of the document. These are the statewide grades 3 to 8 and 11 combined ELA and math proficiencies. So we're proposing to shift the timeline ahead by 2 years. That's the maximum flexibility we are permitted through the addendum process. We are not looking to shift the grad rate goals or the progress toward English language proficiency goals by 2 years, only the academic achievement goals. As I mentioned before, calculating growth this year is simply not a valid measure to use for high stakes decisions, but we have to have something in that gap. So we propose to move science and social studies with their points associated with them from the school quality student success indicator to the academic progress indicator. So it's simply moving from one bucket to another bucket. It does not change the overall accountability system. It's simply moving them to a different spot to fill the gap to meet US Ed's requirement. That impacts elementary and middle schools only. We do not calculate growth at the high school level. So the high school accountability framework remains relatively intact for this year. For our currently identified schools, those would be the comprehensive support and improvement, our lowest 5%, and targeted support and improvement. Those are schools that have the lowest performing or consistently underperforming subgroups. We have the opportunity to delay the timeline for exit for them until fall of 24. Right now, they are on a timeline to exit at the end of this school year. That means we wouldn't have 2 years of achievement or accountability data with which to consider exiting them. So we are proposing to delay the timeline. We know that schools have been facing operational challenges. This would give them extra time to implement their plans, additional resources or continued resources, I should say. And then also to revise their exit criteria from meeting an overall accountability score of 41.33%. If that number does not mean anything to you and you're wondering what that is, all those measures that are in the accountability system have points. We take the number of points that a school earns out of the total number of points possible, and that gives the school a score. So when we identified schools in the lowest 5% back in 2018, that lowest score was 41.33%. That included growth. That was a full complement of the accountability system, and that was pre-COVID. So we would like to revise the exit criteria to reflect better, more local measures, in addition to some statewide measures. So that's for the currently identified schools, and I did provide you with a list of those schools as well ahead of time. And schools that will be identified for comprehensive support and targeted support and improvement this coming fall, we would like to expedite their timeline to exit in 2 years versus 4. We would also like to revise their exit criteria to mirror the revisions to the exit criteria for the currently identified schools. So that puts everyone, the new schools and the current schools, on the same timeline for exit 2024. It also recognizes that schools that we identified now are using fragile data to make those determinations, but it does help to identify which schools are struggling the most and need the most resources and supports, and we're able to target that and help them get their feet back under them in a couple of years. The final flexibility request is to not calculate any ratings this year. We are going to calculate all the measures, report all of the data, but not associate exceeds expectations, meets expectations, approaching and does not meet expectations with those numbers. The feedback that we've heard so far is, you know, please do not use ratings this year because of the ongoing challenges that schools are facing. So those are the 5 major areas for which we are seeking flexibilities. And at this point, I will open it up for questions, concerns, thoughts, and would love to hear your feedback. We will open up, like I said, oh my gosh, I am so sorry. We will open up for public comment next week. So if you think about it and there's additional comment you'd like to make through that process, we welcome that as well. So I will stop there because I have given you a lot of information.
No, thank you very much for that. And you might hear my dog bark in the background too. Mine were going crazy. I wasn't sure if it was yours or mine. So I'm going to open it up to the floor. So any questions from any board members? Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Hi, thank you so much for this thorough presentation. It's Wendy Turner. I just wanted to ask generally how social emotional learning fits into this entire process and all the data, hearing about looking at local measures for exiting schools out of CSI and TSI, I'm wondering about mental health impacts and data. How does that all fit in here? And I do think it makes sense not to apply a rating this year because as a teacher in a classroom on the ground in a school, you know, all the challenges that we're facing, that makes a lot of sense. Can you just speak to those other pieces?
I think you're muted.
Yeah, you're still on mute, I think.
Okay. How about now?
Perfect. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for that. Yes, social emotional learning and mental health. We haven't quite worked out what the local measures might look like, but those are absolutely on the table for being part of evidence for improvement and progress in improving school quality. So those are that's absolutely something that we want to consider as part of that, but we haven't quite worked that out yet. But that's definitely on the table.
Thank you.
It's not part of the accountability system because there's so much variability and local control over that. There's no statewide measure per se for social emotional learning, but in terms of local data, I mean, absolutely.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Hey, this is Audrey Noble. I have a question. Dr. Yanishevsky, did I get that right? Okay.
You did.
I was looking through this report and thanks for making this so understandable. This is really very straightforward and understandable. I appreciate that. I did have a question that came up though, as I was looking through where you referenced us to looking at the long-term goals, and there was a section on educator equity. And then I went to Appendix B, and I was just wondering, like, what's the status of the data for educator equity and the dashboard? Where are we on that?
So that is not in my area of work at the department. Christine, I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Give me just a minute to make sure that she is able to speak.
Okay.
She should be able to talk now if she would like to.
Christine, would you like to talk?
Sorry, I was just waiting to be allowed to unmute. I've got it. Hello, everyone. So I'm going to see if I can. I don't know if my video works too. Hello. Hi, everybody. So, yes, great question, Audrey. So our educator support group is currently working on the revisions to that. We had had the educator dashboard that had been up years ago, went under revision, and they were expecting for early spring. So I know that our lead that was working on that has moved on to a different organization at this point in time. So I'd have to check back with our associate secretary over educator support to see the present progress, but I know that that is the dashboard has been worked on and is expected to be released in the spring.
I just think the research behind that and, you know, the influence of teacher quality on students' opportunity to learn is really kind of critical. So if we could ask that someone from the department when you're ready could come and bring us a presentation on the status of the,
absolutely,
we'd really appreciate that. I think that really aligns with some of our concerns about retention and making decisions about, you know, quality schools. So thank you.
We would agree. We'll do.
Thank you. Any other questions from the group?
This is Reverend Powell. Thank you again for the presentation. It's, as you indicated, it's a lot of information to take in. So I'm trying to get up to speed with understanding. But I do see that there's a delineation between your I guess, traditional schools that are performing at a certain level. And then there are additional recommendations for the current schools that are identified for comprehensive support and improvement and targeted support. And those schools, according to your chart, are schools that are in Christina, Bancroft, and Bayard, and Shortledge and Red Clay, and AI DuPont, and Stanton. So with the thinking of extending, I guess, an exit timeline to the fall of 24, I guess, help me understand the logic behind this. And is this, I guess my question is, how does the equity conversation enter into these particular schools and how they've been impacted during the pandemic? I was told when we talked about accelerated learning that the students that were of low income and of minority yoke would suffer most in the COVID environment and accelerated learning. And so here we're coming out of, I guess, COVID a while in terms of reporting and accountability. So how is the equity conversation impacted in that? That's the first question. And then the second question is, as it relates to the 90% required, 95% required testing in math and ELAs, I guess English language arts. And then you get a haircut if you go below 90% in terms of reduction also. So I'm concerned about that in terms of, the ability to reach the students for testing, virtual learning, and so forth and so on. Is that all? Those are just basically two major questions I had that relate to the presentation.
Sure. I'll answer the last question first, and then I'll turn it to Christine or Mark for your initial question around Christina. So the 95% participation rate factoring in to accountability in terms of proficiency is an ESSA requirement. It is specifically stated in federal law that states must adjust proficiency rates for math and ELA if participation rate in the school is below 95%. So US Ed, like I said, well, for the past 2 years, we've not had accountability, but prior to that, we did factor participation rate in with the passage of ESSA, and now we're back to implementing that requirement. So what we have typically done is for those schools that have not met that 95% participation rate, our Office of Assessment provides additional supports. We work with the schools to find out the root cause of the low participation rates and then work with them accordingly. But of course, that was pre-COVID. And now that we're coming back to that requirement, I think we'll have to wait and see what this spring testing window looks like. We may be surprised, with high participation rates. I don't know. But they're still, it's still variable and speculative. And I think we'll need to wait and see what it looks like afterwards to be able to speak to that.
Reverend, it's Mark.
So for your.
Yep. Thank you, Chantel. Reverend, it's Mark Holliday. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Fantastic. Great question. In regard to the schools that are currently identified as CSI and TSI. In the last couple of weeks, Chantel and Christina Lewis have met with me a couple of times to walk me through the rationale behind those current identified schools remaining for the next 2 years, under support from the department with these additional funds. I think it makes sense because the current data that we have to determine the progress of these schools, their growth, isn't reliable data. Understandably, I think tying into Ms. Turner's question regarding, how are we incorporating social emotional into this is also just very relevant. We haven't quite figured that out yet, because it's very hard to measure. So I guess the point being, we have some additional funds that we will be able to continue to utilize in those schools that have, a high percentage of students in poverty, which can, I think, only help those students in terms of, growth after a period where, so many students didn't have the kind of access they needed to, to a strong educational environment. I think the educators in our schools did amazing work and the best job they could, but I don't think we can kid ourselves and pretend that the last 2 years have in any way that we've been able to reach students academically the way we otherwise would have. And we know, per your point, students who live in high needs communities and attend high need schools, have experienced that more so than any. So that combined with the Wilmington Learning, the potential of the Wilmington Learning Collaborative and the additional resources that it could potentially bring to many of those schools, I think all of those combined are positive resources that could only have, a positive impact on this issue of, I hate this, some call it accelerated learning, others call it learning loss. At the end of the day, what we're talking about is this, the content and activities that students haven't had access to over the course of the last 2 years. What do we do about that? So I'm comfortable at first, I have to say, when this was first shared, I didn't know what to make of it, an additional 2 years, but I really see it as two additional years of continued support that is likely, if not definitely, needed. And my point to Chantel and Christine when I first heard it was, there are plenty of other schools outside of TSI and CSI that could use those kind of resources and strategies. Mm-hmm. But we have to be realistic. This is this is a federal requirement. They require us to identify those schools. I see it as a good thing. I hope that answers your question, Reverend.
Well, I appreciate you placing it in context for me to understand, this diagram. And as you indicated, as a result of the pending collaboration in the Wilmington Learning Collaborative, I would really hope and pray that this is a focus area, with the three schools that have entered into the MOU, so that we can kind of get laser focus on this type of outcomes, measurable outcomes. So that's just my thought. And so I appreciate your response.
Sure.
Thank you for that extra information. It is always nice to have additional context. Any other questions from board members? I actually just have one, and I don't know if you're able to address this or not. How receptive do you think that they're going to be to some of these asks?
You mean US Ed?
Yeah. Like, is there a sense as to, and I know there's, I mean, clearly the lack of information is not just us. So I appreciate you trying to be ahead of the curve, very much so. But do you have any sense, based on kind of conversations that have been had thus far? I mean, I would think that they would be flexible, but I'm just curious if you have any thought on that.
So I was in a national conference just this week with my peers from other states, accountability directors from other states, and US Ed was part of that conference. And based on what I heard this week, in addition to what they've shared a month ago, I'm hopeful about our proposed submission. I don't anticipate any extreme pushback, but who knows? But I am hopeful.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was something you could. Really, you never quite know till it comes back, but okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments from the group? Okay, I'm going to take that silence as a no, but thank you very much. We appreciate you being here tonight. I will say, to the extent that this is a, you know, gathering information from a stakeholder perspective and that it will be out for public comment, if any board members, you know, when they've heard tonight and they're going back and looking at it, they do have something they'd like to share, just please make sure that you communicate that to Ms. Honor and she will make sure that that gets through.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so next on the agenda is furthering our conversation on equity. And as you'll recall, at our January meeting, we discussed some of our next steps related to professional development around how we consider equity in policymaking. So Jenna has engaged with NASB, several other national organizations, to explore how we can move this work forward. So I'm going to open the floor up to her, and she's going to walk through her proposed path forward.
Yes, thank you. We talked about this briefly at last month's meeting. I thought it would just be helpful to give a quick recap of where we've been since our strategic planning conversation last summer. So at that point in time, we determined that we wanted to have a little bit more of a focus on equity in terms of our policymaking, including in our regulations. And so in follow-up, I contacted a few other State Board of Education to learn about the work that they were doing. Related to this, I talked to Washington, D.C., who had a number of committees that are underway focused on this topic, as well as the Nebraska State Board of Education, which developed a process in partnership with their Secretary of Education to more intentionally consider data and research and stakeholder voice in their regulatory processes. At that point, I also contacted NASB for suggestions regarding national organizations that could help support our work in this space. Simultaneously, I worked with individual board members to develop a draft equity framework, which was presented to the board by Ms. Turner in October. Next steps were temporarily paused while I was on maternity leave, but when I returned, I followed up with some of the organizations that NASB recommended, including the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, the Data Quality Campaign, and Education Trust. After holding some of these conversations to sort of determine how we would want to move forward, would like to recommend that we have a professional development session sort of focused on sort of aligning our work and what we mean when we talk about equity, and to be more specific about which areas, data areas specifically, that you would like to focus on. That session would also include some spotlights from other states. I mentioned I talked to some of them. I'd like to bring them in, board members from those states, to specifically tell you what they did, so you can hear directly from them. So I have an outline that I shared with you, just seeking the board's feedback on the direction of that, if you're supportive of us moving forward with some of these general sessions. If you are supportive of the direction, I would like to request that we authorize at least $2,500 of funding from a previous NASB grant that is focused on professional development to move forward our work in this space. So I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments about sort of my proposed direction.
This is something that has been a priority of the board. We've talked about it a number of times, and I know Jenna has put some work into trying to find a good path forward and try to address that there's so much that kind of encompasses this and a number of different ways we could take it. Some other states are doing some pretty interesting things, so hearing from other states I think is valuable. Wendy did a great job, and actually I think she worked with Dr. Noble as well as with Jenna on the equity dashboard that we were looking at in terms of how we view regulations that come in front of us. So this is just kind of another step, but I think that it is, my opinion, worthy of more than just a topic on a board meeting, because we can spend a lot more time, and when we sit in a room and have a really good dialogue, I think we move things forward versus just, you know, on a Thursday night when it's just one item with a number of other things. So I'd really be I'd like to hear from board members. And again, the ask is here, we do have potential grant money that has been out there that would be we could use for a professional development. So with that, I'm going to open it up to the board and thank Ms. Anna for the work that she's done in pulling this together for us.
Yeah, I'd just like to add that the three states that she has listed there are three states that I've interacted with on, with NASB. They've all had a very different road in addressing this equity issue, and they've all come up with different outcomes and different paths forward. I thought that this was a great idea to at least be able to talk to other board members about, you know, what were some of the challenges, what motivated you to do this, and, you know, what was your outcome. And so these three states haven't all done the same thing. So there are different lessons from them. So that's one of the reasons we chose them. So I just wanted to put that out there. I think this is an excellent idea for us to help get focused on, you know, how are we going to address this commitment? This is a commitment we've made in, you know, through our strategic plan. I know we you know, ask questions about equity at every meeting related to most data that we look at, but I think having a, you know, a framework and some guidance from some outsiders would help us think more clearly about how we want to move forward. So I'm in support of it.
Hi, it's Wendy Turner. Thank you, Jenna, for the update and all the hard work. I agree with Dr. Noble. I'm interested in learning if the presenter would talk at all about levers for equity, such as culturally responsive teaching and social emotional learning, and how they currently exist in our preparation system, and how they currently exist in our professional development with teachers. Because as a state board member, if I am doing my homework and thinking about culturally responsive teaching and understanding that this is truly a lever for equity, this will help move students, I then would want to know how many teachers out of our 10,000 strong teaching force in Delaware have these skill sets and competencies, and who are the students that they serve? So are they skills and competencies coming to students in subgroups where we have lower achievement? And how are we keeping track of this with a complex system where data around training, professional development lives in many different silos? So I would be really interested in hearing about that in terms of best practices and how that feeds into policy.
Yeah, I think that point's well taken, especially to extend it beyond the speaker, because I think each of these board member presentations could speak to that, like what levers did they choose and why? And that would help us kind of get informed about how other people are thinking about this.
Jenna, did you want to address that as well? Because she's done some work in addition to identifying specific states, but the speaker. And I read the executive director's report earlier, but I can't see it now, but I've been having other issues from a technical standpoint, so it's no longer here in front of me. Did you want to talk to that? And then, not to put Secretary Holodeck on the spot, but he has also done some work in his role when he was at Brandywine with a speaker, Bob Jarvis.
Yeah, so one of the facilitators that we're considering for this professional development is Dr. Bob Jarvis. He's at UPenn and facilitated the Coalition for Educational Equity there, and he did some work. He's done some work with the New Jersey Department of Education and the Pennsylvania Department of Education, as well as some local school districts, and has been doing this for quite a long time, and had a good conversation with him about bringing in the examples from other states, but then kind of having a foundational conversation for the board around kind of what are the challenges that we all see as a board, how can we kind of talk through the system, what data is available to inform how we have these conversations. So I really see this first session as our opportunity to kind of really look at this broadly, and then hopefully by the end of it get a little bit more specific about which topics we'd like to dig in on further. Ms. Turner and I have had many conversations about starting with data and, you know, who can we bring in to really look at our data more specifically, and, you know, there's any direction that we can go on that. We can look at discipline data, we can look at academic data, we can look at the educator equity dashboard, but really kind of getting our heads kind of all in the same spot around the context that we're looking at this, and then being able to sort of decide on a path forward and where we want to dig in, I think would be the most valuable for us at this point.
Whitney, I would simply add, I mean, I think Jenna captured it, and my relationship with Dr. Bob Jarvis was through Brandywine School District being one of the early participants in what is now called the Delaware Valley Consortium for Equity and Excellence out of the University of Pennsylvania. So they offer an array of different professional development opportunities for staff as well as students. So we're talking about paraprofessionals, especially teachers, especially leaders in some student programs. I think Dr. Jarvis would be helpful with the either the high-level overview or helping create that sort of basic foundation. But I have to say I really like the idea of learning from other states and state school board members or school board members who have gone through an equity initiative. And the idea of identifying the levers or the areas, whatever you want to call them, that you're most interested in a board makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. My experience with a good bit of equity work is that it's a lot, right? And it can be very philosophical and emotional. And I think creating sort of a base foundation and really identifying very specific things that you want to accomplish as a board. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And the chances are, you know, when it's said and done, if you approach it that way, that you'll feel like you're successful. The districts or schools that sort of it fade away from the equity work over time, I think it's usually because it's just too broad, right? We want to do everything around equity, and then we end up doing actually very little. Whereas if you hone in on exactly what it is, what the lever is, or what the particular issue or topic is as a board you want to address, start small, and then perhaps in coming years you can add on.
No, thank you for sharing that. Good perspective. Anyone else that has comments that they'd like to share on this?
This is Shelby Ferris. I very much am passionate about the issue of equity in our schools, and I think this is a great project that we need to focus on. I would be interested in seeing, I know at the very least in Sussex County that there are schools that outsource mental health counselors to come in and speak to the students. I would love to see what they have to say about equity for our students in like low income areas or in like areas with different environments than like what we're typically used to. I feel like they would have a very large insight that we could definitely use when looking at our issue of equity.
Thank you. That's a good thought. I mean, oh, sorry. Am I talking over someone in the room?
No, you're good.
Okay. Sorry about that. No, thank you for sharing that. And we can think about that as a takeaway in terms of how we capture some of that information and how we can use that, because I'm thinking there's frequently work being done that other groups aren't aware of. So to some degree, I wonder, is that being captured somewhere and we don't know it? And if so, can we leverage what's already being done? And if it isn't, then let's think about what we could potentially do to have that be part of our dialogue as well.
This is Reverend Powell. I support the professional development opportunity wholeheartedly. I'm enriched by the different perspectives that I'm hearing around the table. I really can resonate with Mrs. Turner with regards to having some local data that we could perhaps align to would help me to really kind of see how this kind of plays in once we have some outcomes. I understand to look at the high level 50,000 foot perspective of it and what other areas are doing, but you know, we have our own unique opportunities here in Delaware too. So I don't know if Jenna was suggesting that we would have a second session in order to focus on that. That's what I was kind of hearing. If in fact we would not include that in our first session, would that constitute a second session to really look at those areas? So that's just my only thought.
Jenna, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I hope that through the first session that we could identify something a little bit more specific around where we want to focus in on that data. And we can talk about sort of what's the right way to continue that conversation? Is it by pulling data and we have some of these, some follow-up conversations in board meetings, or, you know, do we want to have a specific project or topic that we go further on in the future? I don't think we're going to answer that question tonight, but I think, I hope that that'll be one of the outcomes of the first session. And I hope that, you know, as we continue to have conversations here in our board meetings, that as you think of topics that you think would be good for the board to go deeper on, that you'll send them my way, because this will be something that I continue to work through in the background as I continue to hear feedback from all of you.
And I think that Mark had a really good point, because the broader we take this, the less likely we are to feel satisfied that we are moving forward, because there's so much. So to the extent that we can try to identify where we think that we can actually move something forward and kind of lay the seeds or the foundation to affect, you know, change and learn something in terms of whether it improves our ability to make policy regulations. I mean, those are the things we think about from our standpoint as a board. So to the extent that we can kind of think big, what are other states doing? And then maybe a takeaway from the first session would be, how do we apply that with the information and what we know about our own state? So to Reverend Powell's point, bringing it more local, because we do need to take it more local. But I think that we need to start kind of with a good understanding of potentially what other states are doing. You know, I always feel like we can't work in a vacuum, because there's a lot of really good work that's being done elsewhere. So to the extent that we can learn from what other people have done, I think it's always valuable to be able to take that information forward.
Madam President, Lofink speaking. This conversation has been incredibly helpful. I guess my question right now is, this require a motion to allocate this $2,500?
That does, and I was actually going to go there next if I didn't have any more questions. So thank you for taking us there.
I want to keep the conversation short.
You are on target. So essentially, if we're in agreement, our next step is, we have funding. We have a grant from NASB that needs to be used for professional development. So we'd like to use it around professional development around equity. So what we would need to do next is to have a motion to use the NASB grant funding to support the board's professional development around equity.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Reverend Powell seconds.
Right. Ms. Honor, if you could call the roll.
Mr. Brittingham.
Yes.
Ms. Pfeiffer. Mr. Lopez.
Yes.
Dr. Noble.
Yes.
Reverend Powell.
Yes.
Ms. Sweeney.
Yes. The motion carries. Okay, great. So you're going to be getting emails with dates. So we're going to have to get that scheduled. But I think everyone's really looking forward to moving that conversation forward. So thank you for that. And thank you, Jenna, for the work that you put together to pull that together for us. So next is regulations. The first is professional standards boards. We have Dr. Linnea Bradshaw, Executive Director, Professional Standards Board, to present information on regulations. The first in front of us is Regulation 1511, Issuance and Renewal of a Continuing License. This is for action. And this has come before us before. And Dr. Bradshaw, if you wanted to provide any information before there's a vote on this.
I really don't have additional information, but the Professional Standards Board seeks consent of the State Board to approve the final order of 1511 continuing license. The proposed regulation was published during the month of January and received no comments. So are there questions from the board?
Now, are there any questions for Dr. Bradshaw before we take a vote on this? Okay, is there a motion to approve as currently presented Regulation 1511, Issuance and Renewal of Continuing License?
Lofink, so moved.
Brittingham, second.
Ms. Honor, if you could call the roll.
Mr. Brittingham.
Yes.
Mr. Lofink.
Yes.
Dr. Noble.
Yes.
Reverend Powell.
Yes.
Ms. Sweeney.
Yes, the motion carries. The next item that we have from Professional Standards Boards is Regulation 1549, Dance Teacher, and this is for information only.
So Regulation 1549, Dance Teacher, was scheduled to come before the board with the other arts regulations last month, but it was delayed a bit earlier due to questions regarding the Delta test. You may remember the Delta test from 2019. Originally, this regulation, including this testing requirement, which was the dance entry-level teaching assessment from the National Dance Education Organization. But we had included in the original draft, but we found two issues. And one is that it is not really back online. It's not given regularly now after COVID. The next planned administration is in the spring of 2022, but currently it's only given once a year, and it was not given in either 2020 or 2021. And so it's not established as really being available to people who would like to be certified. So Ms. Conrad and I determined it would be best not to adopt it as a requirement, but we do include it in the draft as an option to receive second certification. We did not want to leave the National Dance Education Association. They worked very hard to put this test together. We don't want to leave it completely in a gutter. And the second issue was that the passing score was set originally in the 2019 version of this regulation at 91. And when we received administration data, and it's only been administered to less than 100 people, but a 91 would result in about an 18% pass rate. And we just didn't think that was appropriate. And looking at the data that we had, we thought that a score of 80 would be a lot appropriate. And it was also 91 was the distinguished score from the National Dance Education Association. It wasn't the passing score. So we decided to move that down. Are there any questions about the Delta? Took a long time to figure that out. And then last, this regulation differs from most certifications in two main ways, mostly because there's a dance education system outside of the K-12 system that in which dance teachers do virtually the same thing that they would do in a classroom. And so we have two additional pathways, and one is for those who are accredited as a registered dance educator through the National Dance Education Association, that is a pathway to certification. And the second pathway that doesn't exist in other types of certifications is for those who earn and currently maintain a certificate in dance instruction from the National Dance Education Association. So leveraging that organization to help with the certification. Does anybody have any questions about the approach?
Any questions?
How many dance teachers do we have?
So I'm not entirely sure. I think it's probably hands and feet, like maybe I think it's under 20. I recently got some data for physical education teachers, mm-hmm. and they were dance teachers. Like, interestingly, there were dance teachers included in that. And so I don't know if it included every dance teacher in the state because it was only about 8. Right.
Okay.
So I can't tell if that was everybody. And yeah. So, but it's therefore not very. They're certainly not in
the district. Linnea, I have a question. If a student was taking dance lessons outside of school by a certified dance instructor, is there a possibility that that could potentially count toward credits, high school credits, and graduation in the area of arts?
So that is not my area of expertise, as far as counting like student credits for outside experience, but
we have Christine here.
But it's something it is an interesting thing to explore, because I don't know if schools do enough giving of, and I don't know like what type of credit, whether it be electric credit or not.
I mean, there are
for like really significant experience outside of the K-12.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I there are opportunities for students to, you know, whether it be through work or in mm-hmm. some cases they have other options and opportunities to secure some credits I do think when we talk about, you know, being more innovative, especially coming out of COVID, that we need to encourage districts to look at ways in which students, in particular secondary students, but all students for that matter, can access opportunities beyond, you know, the bricks and mortar that they're accustomed to. So this could potentially be one of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Now,
so anyhow, that's a conversation perhaps for another group in the department, but I appreciate it.
But I think it's an interesting point. I mean, because we talk about, there's a lot of things that students participate in, like service learning. You know, they're doing contributions to the community. Mm-hmm. And how do they receive credits towards their education? And some districts I know do give credit for those things, like as electives, some do not. So I think there's a whole realm of things there that we could be considering that are, you know, positive for more kids.
I actually just have a question, and this is kind of a broad question, not specific to this one, but you said originally it was a 91 and then you changed it to an 80. What kind of consistency is there across different levels? So whether it be science, social studies, math, you know, dance teacher, art, like, is there, how consistent is a passing score?
Well, that's a really fraught question because generally speaking, we use ETS.
And I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Is that okay if I take off my mask?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Generally, we use ETS for our teacher certification regulations. And ETS does a lot of data crunching and psychometric testing and all of those types of things. That's really not the case in this Delta exam, which is why we really were hesitant to put it in as a certification requirement. but the ETS process is a fairly rigorous process. That being said, I'm not going to say it's foolproof and perfect. And so the process that we have instituted is once ETS develops the test, vets the questions, then they have a panel, they have what's called a multi-state standard setting study, and they go through and they, usually it's two panels of 16 educators each who take the test, rate the questions, and they also come up with the definition of a just qualified candidate and the kinds of skills and knowledge that a just qualified candidate needs to have. And they rate each of the questions that is on the test on a point, like a 0.0 to 1 scale of how what's the probability that someone would get that right. And after crunching all of that data together, they come up with a recommended score value. And once we get that score value, we also have a group of in-state educators who do the same thing. It's not as rigorous a process. It's only about 3.5 hours that we spend based on taking the test, looking at the recommended cut score, looking at the raw score value according to that, and like actually making recommendations about the cut scores for those tests. For example, you might recall that I think in September we passed secondary math. Mm-hmm. And we did that process for secondary math. And the group actually recommended that that cut score be one conditional standard error of measurement, which is kind of like a standard deviation, right, lower than the recommended score value. Because the recommended score value, they just weren't really confident that that. Math teachers are so hard to come by, and that math test currently is like one of the most difficult tests to pass, and they didn't want to repeat that mistake for this test. And it actually turned out to be a good, I've been watching the scores come in, and the recommended score value was a 159. That is too near the mean for me to be comfortable for it to be the score for a high stakes decision. Does that make sense? Because when you make a score, when a score to make a high stakes decision is right near the mean, there's a very high probability that someone
right,
narrowly
it's there in the error.
So
with that one standard deviation below, you know, most of our candidates have been comfortably above that. And it's not, it's a matter of like three questions. It's not, okay. Not super significant. And that was a long answer. I'm sorry.
I was actually thinking, I didn't know I asked such a hard question, but thank you. I appreciate the explanation.
And I think the point is too, that Linnea is referring to is that that work is done within a content area. It's not comparable necessarily.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I think that's what she's trying to do.
You're right. Each content area goes through that once, that separately, so that we have different cut scores for every single exam.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board?
I had the pleasure of going to the PSB meeting here last 3rd. And I was wondering if you would give the board an update on the status of 1581 EBGB regulation.
So we presented reading specialists to the professional standard board. The language in the readings, the revised reading specialist regulation is a little more neutral, neutral between the International Literacy Association standards and the International Dyslexia Association standards. We had previously had the International Literacy Association standards solely, and we had gotten several comments from Dyslexia Delaware and other places that, you know, we weren't being balanced. And so this is an attempt to be more balanced, and we do have one edit that we are still discussing. One of the board members wanted to rename one of the courses listed out as diverse learning profiles, maybe including English as a second language, and we're currently vetting that to make sure that we're not running afoul of anything. That's why I didn't want them to edit it at the board.
Right.
And so I also did, because Jen is thinking, actually prompted me to go through and met the Wilmington University is the only university that has the program, a certificate program that uses the course count, so that's currently in the regulation. Mm-hmm. And we went and currently vetted, they are making sure that they are in compliance with Senate Bill 133 ahead of the deadline. And so we just made sure that everything in that course count actually also fits into Senate Bill 133, so they're able to do that without any other edits to the
Right. So it's tabled for now.
It's tabled until next month, and hopefully it will come through next month. And when it gets published, we'll see.
I refer to it as the heebie-jeebie one because I think the head of your board, when it came up, he said, "Oh, just this phrase gives me heebie-jeebies," because they've been. I mean, I pulled up my documents from last February's meeting, and the reading specialist was on our agenda last February. So I thought, this is wild.
And we had. Well, it took a really long time to figure out what we were going to do. I think we had 147 pages of comments.
I guess the other thing I was interested in, could you talk about the PSB response to your discussion about certification for reading interventionists? Because I know you brought that up at the meeting.
So that is something, and I don't know where that discussion is currently in the department, but there is a cadre of reading interventionists that have had training generally, either it's the pathways to proficient writing training mm-hmm. or letters training 1 and 2.
Right.
Or they can do, I think it's stacks 3 and 4 of the micro credentials in order to fulfill that. And those reading interventionists are funded by opportunity funding.
Right.
And I don't know if we are going to certify those individuals as reading interventionists. Right. I'm not sure. The certification would be not a primary certification, something that we could add.
Well, you know, the reason I bring that up is this conversation stemmed out of our West End research study, if you remember. And one of the things that they pointed out to us is that there were numerous individuals working in reading support activities in the schools that were not certified in anything. And, you know, they went through coaches. But, you know, I was thinking about the interventions, at least that might be a starting point of that conversation of, do we need to be thinking about, you know, developing certification strategies for these people that are providing reading support? Because the reading specialists, and I've done some interviews with some reading specialists around the state, many of them work primarily with the teachers. They don't work with the students. So, you know, getting down to the people that are working with the students other than just the tier one teachers, because there seem to be a lot of them. I think it's something that, you know, in our interest in early literacy, we need to be looking at. So if you're open, if the PSB would like to sit down and talk about the West Ed study and what's in there and, you know, what we learned, maybe we can share some ideas back and forth.
And we did have Judith Ennis come and she did present to the board and
I keep losing Linnea. I know that there's been a lot of dialogue, and actually, to some degree, when Jenna talks about upcoming regulations, we may hear more about when that additionally comes in front of us. But there's also been work from trying to keep track of the WestEd recommendations and move them forward. So, Jenna, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add, if you plan to touch on that when you did your executive director report.
I don't think I have anything to add at this time.
Okay.
We'll talk a little bit about it later when we talk about the NADB literacy grant, I think.
Great. Okay. All right, then let's move that. We can pick that conversation up when we get to that. I know it's always nice if we have Dr. Bradshaw here to kind of have some of those dialogues as well, but I do know that there are other things that you're going to touch on because of some work that you've been doing and some of the outreach that you've done. Any more questions or comments on dance teacher? Okay, then with that, thank you, Dr. Bradshaw, nice to see you. And thank you, Dr. Noble, for some of those additional questions, which I know we're gonna be able to round back on. Ms. Honor, did you wanna give a brief update on upcoming regulations?
Sure, the board has the list of upcoming regulations available to you. Really, I was just going to give that update on reading specialists and also share that PSB tabled the middle school math teacher regulation, but both of those regulations I anticipate will be on their agenda coming up in a couple weeks. So I will share updates following their meeting. That's all I have for now, unless anyone has any questions on the list.
Any questions for Jenna? Okay, great. Now at this time, and it doesn't look like we have anyone in the room, but time's been set aside for public comment on regulations. So the opportunity for public comment on regulations was available via email prior to the meeting. If you did not sign up and plan to provide public comment on regulations and are logged in via the URL, please type in your name, organization, and comment topic in the chat box now. If you're only participating via phone and wish to make verbal public comment, please log in me via the meeting URL. And just as a note, the board will not respond to any questions or engage in dialogue with those offering comments during the board meeting. Jenna, is anyone in the room signed up?
We do not have anybody in the room or online signed up.
Okay, perfect. Then we're just gonna move